Welcome to Linux Lugcast, episode 23. We are an open podcast/lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you are unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us in IRC on Freenode, pound Linux Lugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you would like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community page. With us tonight, well, my name is Honky Magoo, and with us tonight is Crispy150.
Howdy, folks.
Father Finch.
Hello, hello.
Kevin Wisher.
Hello, good evening.
And Taj.
What's good, everybody?
Well, this is a new one for us. We actually have two pieces of feedback, one from email and one from our Google Plus community page. The first one is from Richard Gordon. He emailed us and says, thanks for all the great shows. I really appreciate the content and learning that I get from Lugcast. The show always bubbles up to the top of my podcast listening. I was wondering if any of you do anything special with your home directory when you've got more than one distro on a machine, or if you try to use a home directory or portions of the home directory, like documents or pictures or videos, etc., across multiple distros. If so, how are you setting the things up? I'm mostly looking for some ideas here. I currently have a separate partition that I mount under my home directory, which works okay, but I was wondering about other ways of doing this. Also, any thoughts on this next item? I tried to use my old home directory, separate partition, same username, with a new install of Debian Wheezy, previously had Squeeze, and it didn't work. The old home directory would not mount. Any idea why? I remember hearing the similar problem on Sunday Morning Linux Review, and I vaguely remember something about a UUID problem, but I'm not sure. Anyway, I wouldn't mind hearing your thoughts on this as well. Thank you, Richard Gordon. Well, the first thing I thought of when I heard this was a HPR episode that I heard, I think this past summer, by a man by the name of Matt McGraw. It was HPR 1567. He goes into explaining how he does this exact thing. He also did a write-up on Nightwise.com, and I'll put the links for both of those in the show notes, where he talks about how he was running Zubuntu, OpenSUSE, and I think Arch on separate partitions, and then he would set it up and then do like a symlink to a home partition. Have anybody else ever tried anything like that?
I haven't. I think I heard the Nightwise article when he did it, and I would be afraid that, say, if you have two distros, say if they're on a different one uses a different kernel than the other, you would run into a bunch of problems. But maybe they research that out.
How would the kernels affect the home partition?
Oh, okay. They're doing full Linux. Okay, I wasn't thinking. You're right. They each have their own separate kernel, so they're not sharing any binaries. They're just sharing the home. Well, then I would only think if there was something in the application programs where the configuration files in your home directory, one was behind the other and something had changed. That's the only other thing I would think that would cause a problem.
Well, in the example he gave on the blog post he wrote, it showed that he had initially just set up one home partition and kept on using that, but he had different versions of Chrome on both the Zubuntu and the OpenSUSE, and he was having a hard time with, because you know, each version of each settings are kind of saved in their own, you know, like a .dot Chrome file or .dot Chromium file, and that kind of started to conflict. But when he set it up so that they were doing, created a symbolic link to a to slash share disk slash user slash music pictures and all the rest of that stuff, then it just, I think it was just, the other folders that he might have just did a symlink to, you know, all of the documents and stuff like that, as opposed to the regular, you know, the hidden config files. So all the hidden config files would still be on his original home partition, and then everything else would be symlinked to this other home partition. So all of his pictures and media and stuff like that would be symlinked to the other partition. So each one would have their own, basically still have their own home home directory, but it's all then symlinked to that other home partition. That's the way I understand it, at least.
That sounds far more reasonable than my experience. If I'm not mistaken, I attempted to use a single home directory for multiple distributions when I installed them. But what I had, if I'm not mistaken, and this was years ago, is that if you had one, you know, that you were using primarily, and it had a configuration file with a lot of information pointing in different directions, and then you added another one in, and you installed another program, that program would overwrite the default for the config files, you know, the hidden directories. So that makes a lot more sense to do that, where you're doing symlinks to all the folders where you want your content stored that you share between the distros. It's been a while since I multi-booted.
Yeah, me too.
I've never multi-booted Linux. The last time I dual booted was when I was first found Linux and was, you know, still fall back to Windows. And then what I was doing was doing, like, I think you mentioned symlinking. I created a data partition and then just symlinked, you know, all the my documents, photos, blah, 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 folder, you know, the data folders into my home directory on the Linux side, the Linux boot, so that when I, you know, I could still work with all the same files from both, no matter where it was booted. So I've never had to deal with multi Linux distros running at the same time and trying to share, you know, config files.
Still, that sounds like the same idea, though.
I'm like you, Honky. If I go with one until I get tired of it, or they do something I don't like, or something quits working, and I try something else. I just keep one on my machine until I break it, or it breaks itself, or something goes wrong.
Yeah, I'll try different things, but I got my one solid laptop that I use, Debian Sid on, and you know, I've got Manjaro running on this rig I'm running on, and then we were talking about Kali Linux. So I had my old Acer Aspire Revo my little machine here that I tried to use as a media machine, and then I don't have any use for now. So I threw Kali on that, and I got that one up right now. But that's still Debian based, kind of just like the idea of sticking with what you know, you know.
Yeah, and I'm going through here looking at a Go with Linux. I'm trying to search through their notes. I know they did a pretty comprehensive introduction to dual booting or multi-booting, so that you had one home partition and the most effective way to deploy that when you were trying out other distributions. Once I find that, I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay, does anybody have any other comments about this?
Well, when he was talking about the issue where he couldn't mount a partition as himself because the user ID changed, I'll try to find some resources about that. But whenever you create a new user, it typically starts with user ID 1000, or maybe it's 1001. But if you were to even create a different user in there, depending on the distro, that number would be offset. So the, if I'm not mistaken, the files that are under there are owned by the user ID, not necessarily the username when it looks it up. So you might be able to mount it as root, but you wouldn't be able to access it as your, say, as your user. So you'd need to, I think the easiest way would be to change your user ID when you created a new user, provided that there wasn't a user already with that ID. Let me do a little more research and I'll find something.
Out of curiosity, when it comes to users and stuff, does anybody know whether you're able to keep like one, like you were saying about the keep one user through everything? Because I'm trying to reread this, and he basically had an install of Debian Squeeze with a separate home partition, and then he wiped it and reinstalled and installed Wheezy on there, but he wasn't able to access the his home partition at all because of, he thinks it's because of the UID or unable to access because of the name.
Well, what happens is that each time you create a user, it assigns a unique identifier to that user. So if you created a user and then realized that you created the wrong user and then deleted that user and created another user with that name, that original UID is not automatically put back in the pool. There's a specific command to return that UID back to the pool. So the safest bet is that when you're creating a user, you take a higher number UID, and you always use that when you add the user so that they have the same UID.
And also UIDs are distro specific too, because like on the I'm assuming Debian and Ubuntu are the same. I think your first created user, the first user you create at install is 100, and you can find your UID in the terminal by just typing ID space your username, and that'll give you all your UID, your GID, and groups, and all that good information, what groups you belong to, and what numbers the groups are. But like on this Manjaro install, my user account is 1,000, and I think my wife's is 1,001. So it starts at 1,000 on the Arch-based distros. So that could be, of course, that would be a benefit if you were running a Debian and an Arch. You'd get total, or would it? Would you get by getting, say a 100 on your Debian install and getting 1,000 on an Arch install, or do you want them to be the same? I guess I'm getting confused. I'm confusing myself.
My Debian starts off at 1,000, and my Manjaro starts off at 1,000 as well.
I could have swore maybe it's Ubuntu that starts off at 100. I may be wet. Well, let me check.
If I'm not mistaken, the system is going to look and base your permissions on the UID as opposed to your username. The username is more of a pleasantry so that it's easier for you to recognize and remember as opposed to a number.
I guess I'm wrong. On one of my Zubuntu boxes, my user ID is 1,000 also. I can't remember where I've seen 100 at.
If I'm not mistaken, all the UIDs below 1,000 are reserved for system processes or different, different system level users.
Oh, now I know where I've seen the 100. It's the users group is number 100, because I always put all my users into that group. That's where I'm getting confused. And if any of our listeners have any more insight into where we're going wrong with this, please send us some feedback to correct us and clarify all this confusion.
So the problem would be, would you be able to go in and fix the permissions on that partition, correct?
Well, I can see where you'd get in trouble by mixing everything into one /home/user. If you kept the same username, I can see where that Mr. Gordon that wrote into us ran in, or him that ran into, or was it the Matt McGraw that ran into the issue?
Matt did the HBR. Richard wrote us the email.
Yeah, Richard was the one asking the question, and you referred to Matt McGraw's HPR episode where he ran into the issue after when he was running three different distros and provided his solution with the sim linking. So I can see where it would be very hard to do it all in one home slash user and mixing and matching distros, and then instead of like breaking that up into different folders, still keeping the same partition but making different folders for each distro to where you wouldn't cause any conflict with your config files. Would it even be a permissions issue that you run into, or would it be just like a package version conflict like he was saying about the Chrome issue?
Well, the first part would be with the trying to use the shared home, but the second one, when he was talking, the second half, he was talking about how he went from, he wiped his he had a separate home partition, and he wiped the you know, the regular partition with all the root, all the rest of it on it, and put in, went from Debian Squeeze to Wheezy, and Wheezy wasn't able to read all of his home partition from that when he tried to mount it, or actually would not mount.
I guess in my personal opinion, multi-booting, it isn't worth the trouble and hassle to me. I'll run something in a VM if I need something. That way I kind of keep everything separated. I don't have to worry about rebooting when I want to get into the other distro. I just fire up the VM. It's most likely going to be something that doesn't get used very often, like my Windows 7 VM that I keep around. It only gets started up once a month or so.
Well, I can see maybe coming next year when we start having Steam boxes, or at least the Steam box distribution, that one might want to build a gaming machine. And of course, nothing to do with this, but you might want to have both a Windows and a Linux edition. But you might, you know, since you don't want to build a separate gaming system, you might want to, if you want to play with Steambox, install that on the same machine too. So, you know, if anybody get that working, power to them.
Well, I think it'd be there. You're talking about Windows and Linux, but they can't. I mean, they don't share. I mean, you can share data, but you can't share, you know, system files. So it would actually be easier to dual boot Windows and Linux.
No, but I'm saying one might build a system that was Linux and Steambox, Linux running Steam and Steambox. And you'd probably be smart to install your games completely separately on each one, but there you might want to have your data location for save game files.
But why would you do that when you can just put on a regular distro and then just have it auto start Steam into big picture mode? So basically it is a Steam box with a full Linux distribution behind it.
Well, does somebody want to play a Steam box or want to check, see if there's any noticeable performance differences? I mean, we're Linux people. We tinker with stuff because just to tinker with it.
Is the Steam box based on Ubuntu
or Steam OS? No, it's going to be Debian now.
Really?
Yeah, the prototype that they put out, the alpha or whatever, it was on Ubuntu, and I don't know. I guess they decided Ubuntu was going to be too heavy for them.
I heard that it had to do with Mir, that they were scared that once they switched to Mir for their visual stuff, that the games wouldn't run, and they knew they could make it run under Debian.
And that's a fair point, especially since Ubuntu is the only one who's developing Mir.
Right, they'd get cubbyholed where if they wrote everything for SteamOS to work with Mir, then they'd be locked into Ubuntu.
Right.
Well, and I'm sure Ubuntu will have a nifty, like, compatibility layer between X and Mir, but when hardcore gamers wanted to measure, like, frames per second, then they're not going to want it to go through some translation, which will slow it down.
Right. Now, are they gonna be doing something like compiling their own kernel for that? Because the one thing about Debian is, it's still a pain in the butt just to get Wi-Fi working on some of them.
I would imagine that whatever they're doing, they're gonna optimize it for the platform that's gonna be offered. You know, if you're gonna roll your own machine, you know, there could be the tools and the support for that. But I mean, for the commercial product that they're gonna put out, they're probably gonna customize the whole distribution and the kernel for that platform.
Now on Steambox, we're talking about why you might want to run or SteamOS rather than Linux with a Steam client. Would surprise anybody if rolled into SteamOS or maybe into a lockdown Steambox that you've got some binary blobs that take advantage of hooks into video processors that wouldn't normally be allowed in Linux.
I don't know about not being allowed in Linux, but I guarantee if they've got a commodity item that they've built, that they're going to use whatever proprietary driver works the best to ship it out.
I'd be interested to see that, because that's, in my opinion, one small downside to Debian. And I love Debian, but the one small downside is the fact that it seems very... it seems kind of restrictive when it comes to hardware. I mean, I know Debian stable is a bit back, but I've always run Debian unstable, and even then it still seems like a little bit restrictive when it comes to the hardware and stuff, because the DFSG is still trying to keep it so it is, you know, free. But it does, you know, it's hey, we're completely free, but at the same time, you know, don't look over here, we got the multimedia repositories, and you know, we got the stuff that you can work your Wi-Fi, but you got to kind of do a little bit of tweaking on your own just to get it working. So that's why I was just kind of, I mean, if they get something working, I think that's going to be awesome. I mean, I'd love to find a Debian derivative where all of the hardware is open, the kernel is opened up a little bit more. I think that'd be great. I'd love to run that just as a general OS.
The one thing I have heard from people trying to install SteamOS is that it fails a lot. So I'm assuming they probably haven't got it that worked out.
SteamOS on Debian?
Yeah, the one that they put out is sort of the beta that you could put on machines and stuff. I've known several people who have tried it. Mostly my gamer friends, and they were like, oh, let's check this out. And they tried to install it and it failed. So then they called me and they were like, hey, this is Linux, you should be able to help me. And then we went over and tried to install it and it failed.
They had some very specific requirements initially where you had to have a UEFI compatible system. There were a couple of other requirements, and most machines that were out there, you know, couldn't handle it. I think since then it's been changed, but the restrictions in the alpha were not many people had extra hardware like that lying around that they could play with it.
Now, did it die during the install? Were they able to get anything running at all, or just wouldn't install at all?
It varied. Sometimes it would get there, but Steam wouldn't launch, or it would just fail. It would just wouldn't even start. The installer would just lock up or something like that. It just wasn't. And that's what I told him. I'm like, this is not prime time. So basically, I just I think for the one guy, he wanted to try it because he has always been curious about my Linux obsession. And so he wanted to try gaming because that's his one thing. Like he will not switch if he can't play his games. And I was like, well, you're still not going to play like AAA games because they're not here yet. I think I wound up just installing Ubuntu and putting the Steam client on there. And I was like, and just making it to where it launched as soon as he came in. I was like, basically, this is what SteamOS is. It's just, it works.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've always had a hard time with when it came to gaming on the PC, is I just never had the money to build a machine that was powerful enough to be able to run the games as well as I think it should actually run. That's why I stuck with consoles for so long. And, you know, now that I have a daughter, I don't have any time to play games. But, you know, with a console, the hardware is right. You buy the hardware once and it's pretty much set, and the games are pretty much optimized for the console's hardware, and they usually look pretty well. I know that they look spectacular on other some PCs, but at the same time, you know, I'm not buying a new video card every, you know, year or two, or new monitors or new fancy keyboards or anything like that.
For me, gaming is usually like a NES like emulator or like a video game from 10 years ago. So I'm obviously not the target audience for it.
Yeah, and I actually am the target audience for a Steam machine, because I've done principally all of my gaming through Steam for the past 9 years, or however long that I've been signed up with them for. So I found the beta requirements to build your own Steam machine, and the Steam OS is based on Debian 7, which is Wheezy. But for your hardware requirements, you need an Intel or AMD 64-bit processor, 4 gigs or more of RAM, 500 gigabit or larger hard drive. You need NVIDIA, AMD, or Intel graphics. And then here's the kicker. You need UEFI boot support. So I'm quite certain that none of the machines in my house have UEFI boot support. I can't even try it if I want to.
Yeah, me either.
And to be honest, if you wanted to game on Steam, there are enough lower end, you know, you don't, it depends on what your tastes are. You know, there's a lot of Flash and a lot of diamonds out there that you can go after, but there are plenty of great content games that will keep you entertained for hours and hours that don't have huge, you know, PC requirements. There's one in particular called Faster Than Light, and I looked at my log, and you know, it's a game that I paid probably $5 for, but I've spent 150 hours playing, and I still haven't gone through all the material. It's games like that you know, are going to drive or are going to help supplement the market, you know, aside from the AAA titles.
Well, and I think the good thing that happened is the simultaneous release of Steam on Linux and sort of the Hundle Indie Bundle coming out like at exactly the same time. Because, like, even though I'm not a gamer, I probably have like 100 Linux games in my Steam client just because of the Hundle Indie Bundle. There would be one game that I wanted. FTL was one of those because it's freaking awesome. And you get like 10 other games, but I mean, you know, I'm not going to play them right now, but maybe 2 years from now when I'm sitting around bored, if I'm ever bored, I can pull it out and play it, which is kind of cool. So I think a lot of people got invested in that system pretty quickly.
Yeah. And another thing is that the people that are, you know, the game developers are constantly pushing out more content, which some of it is made available for purchase as in the form of DLC. So they take a game that you like and they extend it if you pay a little bit more. But for instance, FTL, you know, they went and added new races and new missions and new modifications to the ships. And because you already purchased it, it got added onto your game for free. And that's a cool thing.
All right. What's FTL?
Awesome.
It's essentially it stands for Faster Than Light. You control a ship, and you are part of the Federation, which has been overthrown by the Rebellion. Or I might be backwards in that. But you control a ship, and you have to navigate a map from left to right, choosing your waypoints along the galaxy. And you have random encounters along the way, and you might have to fight another ship. You might have a random encounter with a planet or some floating space debris. You might run into a shop, and it's kind of a little bit tower defense, a little bit RTS. You have to play it in order to understand it.
Sounds like Farscape the video game.
There are no Muppets.
See, that's a negative in my book. Now, did either one of you ever do the RetroPie?
Yes, I have.
Is there any sort of a file manager on that thing to be able to pull ROMs off of the network somewhere?
I just SSH'd them over to it. So I think we put like a 16 gig card in it because that's what we had laying around. And I mean, it has everything, every ROM I could get my hands on for every system that we wanted, because my wife is a gigantic gamer. I'm not. And so it was kind of a present for her that I built it. And it didn't even scratch the memory on it. So I wasn't too worried about being able to access off the machine.
Yeah, I just on a whim put it on a spare Pi I had. And the interface for it is absolutely beautiful. I mean, I had tried, it's based on a program called RetroArch, which I had tried a long time ago. But the interface for RetroPie is absolutely beautiful, but I didn't preload any of my ROMs on there, so all I had, whatever they had by stock, which was Duke Nukem 3D, Doom, and some other thing. And, you know, talking about it now, I wanted to put it on there and try to use it, but the likelihood of me actually ever getting a chance to sit down and play it, at least in the next year or so, probably isn't very likely. But one of these days, that little girl is going to grow up, and I'm going to put a controller in her hand, and she's going to do more than just, you know, try to shove it in her mouth or spike it on the floor. She's going to want to play with it and make the little thing on the screen jump around, and I'm going to be ready for it.
Trust me, my daughter's 7, and she freaking loves the thing. You could show her like the shiniest, newest video game there was, and she would rather play Mario.
Yeah, well, I know. My daughter and I had our RetroPie hooked up, and she and I played through the first Legend of Zelda, and she loved every minute of it.
Zelda and Mario, who doesn't love those guys?
Turtles that get stomped on.
Now, how far up can you emulate on that? Were you able to get up to like N64?
I think the highest that we did on ours was Dreamcast. I don't know if it goes any higher. That was just where I kind of felt like it was to cut off loading stuff on there, because I figured if you go past that, it's going to be PlayStation 2 games or PlayStation games, and those are going to take up, you know, most of your SD card.
You got Dreamcast games working?
Not well. So mileage may vary, but it not well.
Oh, crap. I was hoping I could play Power Stone again.
I have a functional Dreamcast, but I don't have that game.
Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, that was the one which was like almost an isometric fighter where you battled over various power-ups in the environment and you got to smash each other.
That's the one. And you could play between, what, 2 to 4 players all at the same time?
Yeah, I had a buddy long time ago who had that game, and we used to play it over at his house.
I miss that game. Well, I think we pretty well rattled this conversation. This did start off with a whole, oh yeah, that's right, permissions on a directory. So did anybody have anything else for permissions on a directory? All right, so our second feedback was from on the Google Plus community page. Chris Harris wrote in and said, "Hey all, I've been listening to a lot of your podcasts, even though most of it goes into my Neo Confuser X brain segment. I really enjoy it. What time zone is 9 p.m. Eastern Time? I like to see what time it is here in Australia. I think it is about 8 a.m. Saturday morning. Since 5150 called out for people to write in, I figured I'd better do something about it. So far as topics are concerned, I was interested when you guys were talking about running a Pi as a firewall. I have an old desktop with 2 Ethernet cards running IPCOP. I've long since forgotten the password and keep thinking I should reload it. Now I'm thinking about a lower power option. Power has become very expensive. Cheers for now, Chris."
Well, to answer the first question, it is at 2 a.m. UTC. So if you can do the math from there, you know what time it is in Australia.
Or just go to timeanddate.com and that'll calculate it for you. I already answered Chris partially in the show notes, because this has come up a couple times on Hacker Public Radio. And I'm sorry, not Hacker Public Radio, Colonel Panic Ogcast. But Jay Lindsay has been of the opinion, we've talked about this, the Pi probably isn't powerful enough not to create a bottleneck, because for one thing, the Ethernet jack on the Pi actually runs through the USB bus. So if you've got anything else running on USB, or, you know, and the fact that the USB bus is slower than a normal Ethernet bus in any case. However, to make a firewall, generally you're going to have to do two Ethernet jacks anyway. And with the Pi, or almost all of the single board computers other than the Banana Pi Model B that is designed to be a router and has one incoming jack and five outgoing, or four outgoing, one of your two Ethernet connections is going to have to run through USB anyway. So that, I think with mostly small board computers, that may well be a terminally limiting factor. Now, the second time we discussed it, the J-Man said that maybe if you're the only person on the network and consuming stuff off the internet, it would probably be fast enough. But if you've got a family where you've got one person looking at YouTube videos and another person is looking at Netflix, it's probably not going to be up to the task. Now, I think the Banana Pi Model B is more money than a Raspberry Pi. I don't know if it's a lot more. Also, you might consider from hardkernel.com the Odroid C1, which is the same price as the Raspberry Pi, and it's quad core CPU, quad core GPU, and it's got a true Ethernet port that's got its own chip. So the single Ethernet card on it doesn't run through USB, but you're going to run that same problem. The second one you're going to have to add on is going to have to run through USB. So you want to be a wise shopper and take all of that into consideration. And the other thing I mentioned, and I could be wrong, I have not heard of any of the firewall distributions like IPCOP or Monowall or whatever being ported to ARM. So if you were to roll your own firewall, I think you'd have to do it through IP tables.
Yeah, I also did a little bit of research, you know, after the question was posted, as to see if there were any of the more popular open source firewall distributions that were running on Pi, and I couldn't find one. I guess about the closest thing you could do is, you know, like you said, roll a distribution and then use IP tables, or roll FreeBSD, I think, is on there now, and then use PF to kind of create your own. I mean, that would be about the only option if you just wanted to play around. I don't have a spare SD card that I could try on my Pi to do that. It would be fun. It would be quite the experiment, and I'd probably get yelled at from the rest of the family. Another option would be, you know, if power is the pinch point for you, it would be to kind of maybe go away from the Odroid or the Banana Pi and just build a small Intel-based, or not an Intel-based, CISC-based PC using a small motherboard, a small power supply, just, you know, with enough power in it to do what you needed to do.
Or you could go Intel-based and use an Atom motherboard. It wouldn't be quite as power efficient as the ARM, but it'd be better than, be better than an old P4, but unfortunately, by the time you get the enclosure and the motherboard and the memory and another NIC, I don't think there's any way you can get out of that for less than $200.
Yeah, and at that price point, you're almost better off finding one of the, you know, a market version of a router or firewall.
Well, a lot of people start becoming concerned about the security in consumer routers that they're not getting their firmware updated often enough, and there are too many potential backdoors into them.
Well, I know on Tilts there were a couple that they were talking about some Asus models that they just purchased that had, you know, pretty good support from the manufacturer and seemed to be pretty solid.
Okay, is there any more discussion this evening on using a single board computer as a firewall or a router? If there's not, do we have time to do my topic tonight, or do you guys want to wait till another week?
I think we have enough time.
Okay, well, I'm bringing been playing with this week, and I saw it on mentioned on HashOddCast Planet on Freenode, and I want to say it was Cprompt who was talking about it. It's an Android app, but it's called Debian No Root, and what it does, it installs a Debian XBMC desktop in an app on Android. And there's a link to the Play Store link in the show notes. And it's not, certainly not 100% functional, but I'll take you through what I have found out. Its name implies it does not require root, which apparently most of the most of the time when you install full-blown Linux like that, you have to have the device rooted. But it does have to be installed on internal storage. You can't install it on an external CD, SD card. And it runs in a compatibility layer, and by my understanding, how that differs from an emulator is that the host must be running compatible hardware. In other words, it's running Debian for ARM, so it has to run on an ARM processor. But it's not a virtual machine, because the compatibility layer does use binaries from the Linux kernel that's running on Android, so it's pulling what it can get out of the Linux. It's the base for Android, and then whatever else it needs, the GNU part, those binaries are installed, and then it doesn't really come with much in the way of applications, but you can pull in applications from the repositories. So the first time I ran it after the installation, actually I installed it from, I brought up the PlayStation page, and of course I was logged into Google. So Play Store page on my laptop, and I clicked to have it installed from there. So it did it in the background, because I was running another process on the Nexus 7 tablet at the same time. So, but then I went in and I found I had a Debian icon, clicked it or punched it, whatever. And first time says, you know, this is going to require 600 mega files. Are you really sure you want to do this? And you say, yes, I want to go ahead and try it. And it says, well, go away, because it's going to take a while. So then the second time, you can see if you click on it, you can see a bunch of files expanding like you see when you do system update. And eventually that finishes, and then you can see a Linux startup process, and eventually XFCE comes up. Now, one of the problems with XFCE, it's not touch aware. So actually what you're doing, you're using the whole entire surface of the tablet as a trackpad. So there's a cursor on the screen, a mouse pointer, and you use the whole surface of the screen as a trackpad to make that mouse pointer hover over what you need to click on, and then you do a single tap on the screen, and that's a left click, a double tap with two fingers at once is a right click, and then dragging two fingers up or down is a scroll. Unfortunately, bringing up the virtual keyboard obscures half the Debian desktop. So it would be recommend if you were actually going to use this for anything, go ahead and buy yourself a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse. If you want sound support, there is a script and an icon on the desktop that says, it says enable sound. And if you click on it, it's going to ask you, are you sure you want to do this? Because that's going to be another 100 meg. And you let it go ahead and do its thing. Now, I don't know. I installed Mumble, but it doesn't see any sound devices. And then I've installed VLC, and I don't see any of it. It looks like it's run through apt-get. It looks like it installs, but it's not in the menu. And I don't know if I'm supposed to be able to do this or not. I type VLC in a terminal. It doesn't do anything. It also, the Play Store page also mentions Exhale for an audio player, and it didn't. It looked like it installed, but I can't find it anywhere. And finally, when I couldn't come up with any audio devices for either input or output in Mumble, I tried to install PAVU control, pulse audio volume control, and it looked like it installed, but I can't find it anywhere, and I can't seem to run it from the command line. Now, by default, there's neither a user or a root password. So to do things like apt-get install, you run the root terminal. There's no password on it. And so as it's neither su or sudo seem to be installed by default. I want to change that. I want to password it. But I was going to wait till after this show tonight. So if I made a mistake, I wouldn't lock myself out of being log in the whole thing. Also, there's no login prompt. It just goes straight to the desktop. I want to change that too, principally because I would like to try if there's a touch-aware desktop for Debian that I can put on. I'd like to try it and see if that makes it easier to use. And another note I've seen online is if you're going to install packages, you want to do it with apt-get because Synaptic tends to be unstable. Not many applications are included. In fact, the only ones I saw were the Terminal, Synaptic, and Thunar. And the file manager does have access to the internal SD as well as the virtual hard disk. If you want a browser, you'll have to install IceWeasel. Let's see. And if I had gotten audio installed, the Play Store says that audio is terribly laggy, so it's doubtful I would have been able to use Mumble for much good effect. Are there any questions?
So overall, how did you view this? Is it a step forward or is it a step towards... a positive step towards Linux on a tablet?
Well, at least it lets you experiment on how Linux on a tablet would be. And it seems fairly responsive. I've heard some people say it was pretty slow, but like I said, there's no media applications. I haven't been able to get sound working so far, and I'm not sure what to do at this point if it doesn't just, how to fix it if I can't make it work. Maybe see if any sound devices are detected. LSPCI didn't work and I couldn't install it for some reason. So, but most of the stuff I tried with an apt-get install, it installs just fine. I did try to install TuxRace earlier today, and I wonder if it says it's not in the repos, and I wonder if it's not because it probably hasn't been ported to ARM.
Well, it's not using an ARM repo. It's using the standard Debian Wheezy repos.
Well, I think it's Debian Wheezy for ARM because it knows it's running on an ARM processor. If I do cat/proc/I had it here earlier, but it knows it's running on Android or on ARM rather.
The sources.list file looks like just a regular it's pulling just from Debian Wheezy, the main contrib non-free.
Well, you're right that you'd have a different, you'd think you'd have a different source list for ARM.
Yeah, I know on the, on I want to say on the Raspberry Pi, it's pulling from a different repo, an ARM repo. Yeah, because this sources.list has regular Wheezy with contrib main and non-free, and then with the addition of a Wheezy backports. I'd love to be able to run a different desktop environment on it.
Well, that's exactly what I said. Is there a TouchAware desktop for Debian?
Is there a TouchAware desktop?
Yeah, I think. Unity is, and I thought that GNOME 3 was.
Yeah, but there's no way you're going to run either Unity or GNOME 3 well on such a small device.
No, and probably not KDE either. Well, certainly not under, well, it's not an emulator, but not under a compatibility layer.
Right. Yeah, I installed it as soon as I saw the saw you put it in the show notes, and this thing is pretty cool. I haven't installed any packages yet. I just wanted to see what it was and how it was set up.
I'd love to try it, but then I would start my rant of why 16 gigabytes is not enough space on any device, and it's about time people started making devices with more memory.
Well, that's why I made sure I got the 32 gig Nexus 7. Even so, I wish it had a card slot.
What are you putting on there that you need so much space?
Everything. That's a Well, see, this stupid phone I have here, about four months ago, I filled up the Dalvik cache, and, you know, one way to fix it would be to root the phone, but since it's a commodity phone, it's a Walmart phone that their pay-as-you-go service, it escapes me, but, you know, there's some on it, XDA, I don't think anybody's ever spent time on it to solve it yet. And there is some stuff like to take it back into a fast boot mode that you can, if you can get into there, supposedly you can clear the cache, and it looks kind of scary to me, trying to do that. So no matter how much space I've got on the phone and on the card, I can't install anything anymore on it.
Is that just from too much apps, or is it from what's that from?
Well, like I said, it's the Dalvik cache. You know, it's this sort of mysterious thing. The only way to do it is just clear. Is if you had root, you could clear the cache anytime you wanted to. Or, like I said, there you can run it into an alternative boot up mode and a way to get in there, supposedly to clear the cache without losing anything. I just haven't had the time to delve into it that deeply. So it really has nothing to do with how much space you have left in the storage.
Now, what device did you put this on?
The Debian No Root. It's on a Nexus 7, 32 gig, refurbished. I think it was from last year. Apparently, I understand from the Nexus 7 are actually different depending on when they were manufactured.
See, I put it on my Galaxy S4, and it's nice. It's interesting, and I'm not sure how, you know, functional it is. But one thing that's starting to bother me is when I did the install, it said lay the device down flat, and now if I move the device around, it moves the cursor around, and that's getting kind of annoying. I mean, if it was just the user screen as like a touchpad, that'd be fine. But this whole moving the device around kind of moves the thing around, just is starting to bug me.
There's a way to disable that in the startup screen. I believe it talks about it on the play page.
I'll have to check that out. I'm trying to install Gnumeric right now. I figured that was a program that shouldn't take up a lot of resources and hopefully be able to run. I mean, it doesn't require any sort of media things, but it still would be a functioning tool.
Yeah, there's a good idea. Well, I was thinking XChat because I never have found a IRC program that I like worth a darn on Android yet.
That's a good idea. Now, are you using like the hacker keyboard?
I'm just using the stock on-screen keyboard.
Now, have you been able to use the little control, the shift alt control in the bottom left-hand corner?
No, because when I bring up my keyboard, those are obscured. And I tried to assign push to talk for Mumble to one of those, and Mumble didn't seem to recognize it when I clicked there. So I don't know what those are for. And for those not to see, we're doing taskbar, if that's not the right word, it's over on the left hand side. Everything is labeled 90 degrees on it, which I guess would be the only practical way to do it. In other words, the letters are going from top to bottom rather than left to right.
Yeah, just because I've gotten so used to using swipe, I haven't installed the hacker keyboard. But if I'm going to stick around in this Debian thing, I'm going to have to install the hacker keyboard because not having control. I mean, I just went into, like I said, I went into the sources.list file and I couldn't hit control X to get out of it. I just had to basically close the window.
Well, I'm glad you told me because I've been trying to think of that. I've been thinking surely they put some sort of key combination or something you could, because they seem to have thought of a lot of things on this. My whole problem is every time I open and close a terminal, it's very hard to resize. And if I do get it resized, it isn't persistent. It's back to whatever size they had it set. Of course, that's probably in a config file somewhere. I would like it to set that a terminal window takes up the top half of the screen. Because of course, when you bring up the keyboard, it obscures the bottom line in the terminal window.
Right.
I mean, for right now, is this truly useful for anything? Probably not, because you can get now. LibreOffice or OpenOffice for Android, though. I mean, it's not like we're short an Office package. I think it would be a nightmare to try to use the GIMP on this or anything like that. And like I said, for right now, at least my audio doesn't work, still doesn't work at all when they say it should. So I don't think this is practical for saying, oh, I'm going to start Android and immediately launch this and have myself a full Linux machine. Is it instructive to see what Linux might look like on an ARM device? Yeah, I think it probably is. But I think, you know, definitely we're going to, if you're not using a separate keyboard, you're going to need a touch-aware desktop of some kind to make it practical. And like I said, if we're going to do that, I'm not sure if Debian's really the underlying Linux that I would have picked.
Just on a side note, while watching this thing try to install Genumeric, it's actually pulling down the ARM files. It's not pulling it from an ARM repo, but it is pulling down the ARM files.
Well, we ought to get Handsome Pirate on here some to talk about that. He could probably explain to me or explain to us. Maybe it's all done through the same repo, of course. Well, he couldn't probably explain Debian since he's a Fedora guy.
Either way, it's a fun little thing to play around with.
Well, I thought it'd be interesting to a lot of the listeners. I don't think it's restricted. I believe there's a lot of these full desktop Linuxes if you have root, and I'm not sure this is the only one if you don't have root. But you know, if you don't want to put in a whole lot of effort of making modifications to your Android system, This is a fun thing to take a look at. Another thing, I think I tried to install OpenSSH Server. Well, I did install it. It says it installed, but I still get refused connection if I try to log in. But I wonder if that's because my user account is not passworded. I don't think you can SSH into an account that doesn't have a password.
Did you try attempting to change your password?
Well, like I said earlier, I didn't. I envisioned if I tried to mess with passwords, I might lock myself out entirely, which I wanted to wait till after this broadcast to experiment with.
It would be really exciting to do that live, or at least an HBR episode.
Yeah, we could do that as a continuation.
Because I could see something like this if, you know, you have a tablet that has a lot of idle time, using that as an SSH server would be pretty neat.
Well, that was mentioned too, that if you got, I don't know if anybody's got old phones around that that would have the space, they probably would, but take an old Android phone and build a web server out of it this way. I think that's kind of going a long way around, but I could connect to it sees the web, because I could certainly connect to the Mumble server. It just didn't see any audio devices in or out that it could use.
Now, is it able to see your camera?
Well, let me install Cheese and we'll see.
Yeah, because if it could see your camera, I mean, with a web server, you've got something that could wirelessly attach to your network. It just need a low power supply and you'd have a camera, you know, available to place anywhere on your network that you could view a video stream pretty easily.
Yeah, but let's be honest, you could probably just do that with an application in Android anyways.
Yeah, I actually had a buddy who took an old Android phone and converted it to a web camera for his front door.
I played around with that too when my daughter was first born. I was kind of trying to set up a kind of a video monitor for her when she was little, but it didn't ever really work out the way I wanted it to, so I just gave up on it.
Yeah, we did that when our chickens were just little chicks, when we had them in the brooder in the basement. We wanted to keep an eye on them from wherever. We set up the Raspberry Pi with a webcam as a server so we could see that they were all face up or head up.
Now, is that a concern? Like if one keels over, you want to get it out of there before it spreads an infection?
No, it was more, I think, comfort for us to make sure that they weren't dying or that they weren't drowning or that we hadn't put something in the brooder that caused harm and that would carry over to others. I don't think it's a disease thing.
Well, it's installing Cheese. Has about a minute to go.
Still waiting on Genomeric.
That must be a bigger program than I would have thought. I can see if you were installing LibreOffice, you'd be there all night.
Yeah, I didn't think so, but apparently there was a lot of packages that needed to be installed.
Well, that's part of it. There's probably a lot of libraries that would normally be in a default install of Debian that they've stripped out of here.
I think you're right.
And one thing it does say on the play page is, because the way it's done, if you ever uninstall the application, you'll never be able to get it reinstalled.
So if you uninstall Debian no root, you can never reinstall it?
Yeah, I guess that might be, you know, unless it's something that gets fixed in a later version.
Well, that's kind of weird. Wonder if the if you uninstall it, if it uninstalls all the packages and just the whole kit and caboodle.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it would wipe the virtual drive, which is where all this stuff would be going. For that matter, I don't know how big a virtual drive they created and if it's dynamic or not. So, you know, if you start getting too crazy installing apps, you might fill the drive up. Not the actual storage, but the virtual drive. Now, this is definitely much more a proof of concept than a viable option. However, I think it shows we're getting close.
Got your numeric limit.
Sweet. Now, you know, I'm worried about stuff like all the Vivaldi stuff. Has that ever been pushed upstream? Surely it must be out there for somebody. And I understand they were trying to get something back out of all their efforts by selling a physical device. But, it seems like a lot of that work would be help a lot of people to develop touchscreen apps, and especially for ARM.
Well, instead of seeing a tablet-like device, the one thing that I've seen that I really wish was more affordable for what it is the Dragon Box, which is like the old Open Pandora, but it's their newer version. But it's so ridiculously expensive for what it is. I could go buy like an actual laptop for what that little device costs. And I mean, I understand it's a small production run and they have to do, custom making on all that stuff. But I think if you could produce something in that form factor, a lot of people like us would adopt that, especially if you could get telephony in it to where it could be your cell phone.
Well, they managed to get a lot of, with the custom images for it, not with the stock stuff, but for the old Zip It 2 years ago, it was almost nearly a practical computer that you could carry in your pocket. Of course, once we got Android, that became, that became less attractive. But there were a lot of stuff I could type a letter on it. I could send email. We weren't that far away not very long ago. I think it's just when the market appears, somebody will produce the device. Right now, the only people interested in stuff like this is a few geeks like us.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was a market for a real Linux laptop, or rather a real Linux tablet, we'd have one.
I don't know. I kind of think there would be if you just build like the, because I see people like a lot of vendors who go into supermarkets and do their orderings and stuff like that. Some of them have these little handheld devices, and some of them have these like full-fledged tablet type things where they sign off on stuff. And some of them, a lot of people are running like iPads and stuff like that. But I'm sure if you put something together and kind of just market it correctly, where you have just specific applications and stuff like that, and just have it on a machine that's going to run better than, my mother is a sales rep, and they gave her an iPad, and that thing just apparently runs as slow as dirt, but she's got to use it for work. And if they can build something, I've seen people using the Microsoft tablets for stuff like that, you can probably build a better machine. Or try to, as long as you can find the right tools, the right applications, and just try to market it towards these people. I don't know. I think it can be out there. No one's ever taken the time or an effort to try to put it all together and market it to the right people.
I think you just described Android.
True, but I've never really, I don't think I've ever seen an Android device that people adopted for this. I've seen iPads and I've seen Windows devices, but I haven't seen Android devices.
Well, I think the reason for that is it's the same way in education, is because an iPad is an iPad is an iPad. It's sort of, except for the generations, it's a monolithic sort of system, whereas, yeah, you could divide, do your educational or your corporate or whatever software apps and design them for a Nexus 7 or for a Samsung tablet or whatever. But you're going to I guess you should be able to use the same apps on all of them. But as far as the corporate culture and all that, they all want to buy the same thing. It looks exactly the same and works exactly the same way. And for, the freedom of Android scares them.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, too.
I mean, if you go in education, and this year you hand a teacher a Nexus 7 with Android apps to do their classroom stuff, And then you come back in 2 years and you hand them a Samsung tablet with exactly the same apps, but the home screen is going to look different and all that. And they're going to say, well, we can't use this. It's different.
We're not even at the point where you can do that. There are not enough Android apps that are education focused that I've seen that even compare to what the iPad has right now, to where it's not even an option.
Yes, but that's my point. That's why they're writing them for the iPad and not for Android. Because Android is a more nebulous sector. You know, not all Android devices are the same. Whereas if I tell you, you know, we're going to put this on iPhone 6, and everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about, and they know they can fold it up in their pocket. Yeah, cheese is still expanding files here.
Well, do we have anything else for tonight?
Yeah, I have one other little thing that I added to the show notes. As you know, a couple weeks back, we had Ken Starks as our guest, and he underwent his surgery, and there was an article posted on Foss Forge by Larry Caffaro about his progress, and it updates it as the surgery went as well as could be expected for somebody having their larynx and lymph nodes removed, and he's resting well in intensive care. But Ken had put out a request on Google Plus about a week back, or maybe 2 weeks back, about something that he was looking for. So if anybody in the audience has any ideas, he is against one of those larynx, you know, devices that you hold to your neck so that you can talk through the vibrations. He's completely against it. So he's looking for some sort of text-to-speech solution, and maybe like a tablet or a small form factor device where he can use text-to-speech to communicate with people. So right now, all the offerings he's found doesn't meet his needs, and he's actually not completely... he doesn't mind if it's not open source right now. He just needs a functional method with which to communicate to other people. So if anybody has any ideas or suggestions, you could send them to us. We would be happy to pass them on to Mr. Starks.
What about one of those translator deals? Is there any way they can be set up? You know, you type in English and it comes out Spanish on the other, you know, it's Spanish, and then they speak Spanish into it, and it comes up English. Is there any? I wonder if there's any way to configure one of those as English to English.
Yeah, I'm sure there might be something like that. We'll look into that.
Or just, is there anything like Festival for Android or eSpeak? Surely there's a text speech app in Android. I guess probably not if you guys haven't found one.
Yeah, well, he's mentioned that he's worked with Festival and eSpeak, but it's still, he hasn't been able to get anything but the, you know, base voice work, where it's the default eSpeak voice. So it's too robotic for day-to-day communications. He's looking for something a little more human, I think.
Well, I've installed the, I had notes on it, I probably closed them. before the 24-hour show, because we'd had some discussions on the HPR mailing list that, of course, we're using eSpeak for the show preamble, so that people can see where they actually want to listen to the show or not, and about how long a show it's going to be. And we had a couple contributors on there. They're also blind users, and they listen to eSpeak voices all the time, and they say, man, that eSpeak voice, you put on one of the other eSpeak voices, they're more natural sounding. And I played with that some, and I discussed with Jonathan Nadeau during the 24-hour show, and I said, you know, Jonathan, Yeah, those other add-in voices, they do sound a lot more natural, but they're harder for me to understand. I miss words, where the default eSpeak voice, I get every part of it. And he agreed with me, says, yeah, those more natural sounding voices, of course. And I thought that the folks, the contributors had written in, of course, they, you know, do all their interviews through the computer, through a generated voice. So they probably don't, you know, they work with it all day. They probably don't have any trouble understanding the quote more natural voices. But Jonathan agreed with me, you know, and he, you know, he's a very practiced listener, of course, to those generated voices. And he says when he speeds up a podcast, or of course, when, you know, when he speeds up the interface to his computer, he goes back to the default eek voice, because when he is speeding up audio 10, 20 times, that default voice, I mean, he can't do that with the more natural sounding voices. He has the same problem I have, that he misses words. Whereas if he goes back to the default eSpeak voice, it's far more understandable. So I don't, you know, my advice to Ken would be to stay with the stock eSpeak voice, even though it doesn't sound very natural. You know, you got feedback from both a sighted and a non-sighted listener saying that the default voice is more easier to understand than the add-in voices.
Well, I think this is a different use case scenario where he's presenting this as his voice when he's interacting with people, as opposed to consuming media in the, you know, or interacting with the device. So he's using this to present to somebody else his own voice, and I don't think that he wants it to be so robotic, that he wants it to be more natural. So, you know, breakdowns in communication aren't going to exist in the natural course of conversation where you're speeding up dialogue. And I think that's why he wants to find, you know, something that can seem a little more fluid, a little more natural, as opposed to the default eSpeak voice.
Yeah, but Father Finch, I don't think you're following me. I'm saying if I play a paragraph of text in default eSpeak, I can understand every word at 1 to 1, not sped up. If I use one of the other quote more natural sounding voices, there's words in there I don't understand. And my advice to Kent would be, he's going to be dealing with people like me who don't you know, who don't listen to generated voices all the time, and certainly not sped up. But I said, I was thinking talking to Jonathan reaffirms my opinion that even though it's more robotic, the default eSpeak voice is easier for anybody to understand than the quote more natural voices. So I think he would much rather have a robotic voice than everybody saying, can you repeat that again all the time?
True, but I think he also wanted to not have a robotic voice because he's dealing a lot with children, and it's the same reason why he doesn't want to use the one of those throat things, is he doesn't want to scare to the children.
Do we know if
Yeah,
he's
and that's just too bad. When he was in here, he was talking like he didn't think he'd have to use one of those, I thought. Or maybe eventually he'd be able to learn to speak without it.
wanting to do something that is a keyboard input or a touch input?
I think his preference is for a keyboard input.
Well, again, you could always pair it with a Bluetooth keyboard in one of those cases that puts the tablet or the phone, you know, attaches it to the keyboard.
Yeah, and I think that would be something that would be ideal, like a Bluetooth keyboard attached to a phone, or, you know, even a tablet that it could carry around. Something that's easier to knock out words, you know, for something that he's spent his life, as he types, learning, or as, you know, the most effective way that he can convey his thoughts or his responses.
Well, the main thing we need to say is, hey, medical community, it's 2012, and we're still using those neck vibrator things that you put up to your throat. Can't you You know, can't you build an internal synthesizer?
That was the gist of his post when he was asking for assistance, was that the technology's 50 years old and there haven't been many improvements to make it more, you know, easier to use or make it more human. So if anybody out there has any way to help Ken, you know, get in touch.
I think the community should take it on, and I think we should build them a thing. I think we should all get to get into it.
See, I think the biggest pain is going to be size. That's why I think something along the lines of an app for a tablet or phone would be perfect. All right. Does anybody have anything else for tonight?
No, cheese is still expanding files, so I'll have to let you know.
All right. So our music is downright provided by Klaatu and Brome. We want to thank Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, and a nice script to keep our IRC bot connected. And we want to thank Delwyn for providing the Mumble server that we use, creating a bot module to find the next show recording. All you have to do is type ns.ns in the IRC command line. And our next show recording will be February 6th. Everybody have a good night.
The Sunday Morning Linux Review is a weekly podcast with three hosts: Tony Bemis, Matt Enders, and Mary Tomich. They talk about Linux and open source subjects ranging from kernel updates, newly released Linux distros, Linux reviews, and tech news of the week. There are also special segments including Mary's Quiz Show, Is It Alive? They broadcast live on Google On Air, Audio Stream, and chat on IRC. For details, please visit the website www.smlr.us.